Well, evening, everybody. It's great to see you all out tonight. We're up to episode 5 in our series in the book of Esther, and we're going to do something ever so slightly different this evening. Usually, when you follow a story through the Bible, you're always following the hero, the protagonist. But tonight, we're just going to slow things right down, and we're actually going to consider the antagonist of the story, the bad person in the story, the enemy of the Jews, the man named Haman. And we're going to do that because Haman embodies everything that the whole Bible has to say about pride. So we're going to look at this character. We're going to look at a couple of chapters in the book of Esther, but we're also going to consider a little bit topically and a little bit thematically pride and what is pride. Haman's story is the story of what happens when pride is left completely unchecked. Now, this week, as I was scrolling through one of my feeds, I came across the story of a 7-year-old out in Arizona who was bitten by a rattlesnake. The story was peculiar because it took so long for the medical professionals to diagnose the problem. Her family had been out for a walk, and the little girl fell. And they noticed after she had fallen that her ankle began to bruise and turn black. And so they took her to the hospital. And then she began to get sick at the hospital, and she was throwing up. In between the first kind of visit to the hospital and the second visit to the hospital, because she went in and they sent her home, and she said, oh, she just has a sprained ankle. So she gets sick. They go back to the hospital because it's not usual that a 7-year-old starts throwing up from a sprained ankle. And no one can work out what's wrong with her until they run a toxicology screen on her and they discover that she had been bitten by a rattlesnake. At this point, her leg had started to turn a dark color and they couldn't identify what this was because there were no puncture wounds. No one ever saw a snake. No one ever heard a rattle. It ultimately took 40 vials of anti-venom to finally stabilize this young 7-year-old girl. Pride is a poison, a deadly poison that has no puncture wounds. It's almost like the carbon monoxide of sin. It is odorless, scentless, and for most of us, completely undetectable. And so I always want to point out 3 things by way of points and questions tonight. Firstly, the poison of pride. Secondly, the toxicity of pride. Thirdly, the antidote of pride. So number 1 tonight, the poison of pride. What is it? What is pride? Look back with me to Esther chapter 3. That was the part of the story that we didn't read. We heard about Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha. He had been promoted to second in command over the entire empire of the Persians. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, interestingly, because the king had commanded them that they had to do that. So that probably is already a clue to the type of person that Haman must have been, that the king had to tell everybody, make sure you bow down to this guy. But Mordecai, we read in verse 2, he did not bow down or pay homage. And the king's servants asked, why don't you listen to the king? Then they spoke to him day after day. And he told them that he was a Jew. And then Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or paid homage. And Haman, we read at the end of verse 5, was filled with fury. But he was so filled with fury that he didn't just want to get rid of Mordecai. He actually decides that he wants to get rid of all of Mordecai's people. He wants to eliminate and kill and commit genocide on all of the Jews. This is the poison of what pride is. Mordecai refused to give respect that Haman felt was due to him. And we read in chapter 5, which we did read this evening, in verse 11, that Haman actually goes back and recounts to his family how rich he is, how many children he has, how many promotions the king has given him, how he has advanced above all the officials and servants of the king. And then verse 12, Haman said, even Queen Esther, she's invited me to this special banquet. Verse 13, yet all of this is worth nothing to me so long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gates. That is the poison of pride. Pride, according to the Bible, is the obsession that a person has with themselves. It is total, unrelenting self-absorption with yourself. As the young people would say today, you are the main character, you know that you're the main character, and you make sure that everybody else knows that you are the main character. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He said, pride is the ruthless, sleepless, unsmiling concentration on the self. It is the ruthless, sleepless, unsmiling concentration on the self. This is what pride does. It makes you so concentrated and so focused that everything is for you and about you and to you that you can't do anything, unless it makes you feel good about yourself. Unless it makes you feel good about yourself over others. And therefore, when a person is prideful, it means that nothing is ever about the thing that they are doing or the person to whom they are doing it. It is always about them. A person who suffers from pride is not able to take any pleasure in anything unless it has some bearing on themselves. They're not able to take pleasure in having something, but only to have more of it than the next person. They can't be happy that they're fit and able to run a marathon unless they're fit and able to run a marathon faster than their friend is able to be fit and run a marathon. Or to put it another way, and this is sort of one of those, this has an age rating on it, a person that suffers from lust, lust might actually drive you to sleep with a beautiful woman because you want her. Pride, however, drives you to sleep with a beautiful woman just to prove to yourself and to everyone else around you that you can, and that you can do it over all others. A prideful person gets no pleasure out of it. They derive no pleasure from it, only from knowing that they could do it. And I want you to take that example and think about how you might distill that into other areas of life where pride comes to the fore. And that's the reason why Haman loses his mind with Mordecai. He literally loses his mind. Right? He has been promoted. He is number two in command over 127 provinces that stretch as far east as the known world is known to as far west, except maybe for Greece, as the known world is known. He is number two. And yet that one person, Mordecai, that Jew, who won't give him the honor and the respect that he deserves, causes him to go into a complete tailspin. And that's what pride does. Pride creates an endless, sleepless ego calculation. Pride causes you to always be calculating every single thing that you do against every other person that you ever come across or every other experience that you ever have. Pride says, I deserve honor. I deserve appreciation. I deserve affirmation. Pride is always talking to the other person, asking themselves, what does that person think about me? What does that person make of me? Does that person think I'm smart? Does that person think that I'm good looking? Does that person think that I'm intelligent and that I know what I'm talking about? Does that person think that I'm better than they am? Does that person want to aspire to be me? That is the poison of pride. And when it comes to pride, pride is so unrelenting. The poison of pride is so unrelenting that it actually has occupies two ends of the spectrum, all right? So pride occupies two ends of the spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, pride occupies superiority. We're all familiar with that kind of pride. Somebody thinks that they are better than everybody else. All right, we all know that kind of pride. We know someone that suffers with that kind of pride. We get fed up with that person. But on the other end of the spectrum, pride is also occupied by having an inferiority complex. There is actually an inferior form of pride. And it's really interesting because Haman actually suffers from both forms of pride. He's always doing his calculations. He's always adding up and making sure that he's getting what is due him. Up until the point that Mordecai would not bow. But then we read in chapter 5 that he actually suffers with the inferior form of pride, where he goes and he recounts everything to his family and then says, but I can't be happy. I won't be happy. I cannot rest until something is done about that Jew Mordecai who I see sitting at the gates every single day. The inferior form of pride, I wouldn't say that one is more sinister than the other, but the inferior form of pride makes a person always beat themselves up, always think less of themselves, always undervalues themselves. The superior form of pride always presents itself in this sort of arrogance, but the inferior form of pride usually manifests itself in a person being completely or lacking any ability whatsoever to think that they are good at anything. And you might think, well, that person just suffers with low self-esteem. And I'd actually say, no, the root of that low self-esteem is pride. According to the Bible, true humility, and when you begin to sort of paint this picture of pride that's superior on one end of the spectrum, pride that's inferior on the other end of the spectrum, you begin to discover what true humility is. According to the Bible, true humility is not thinking less of yourself, all right, because that would be a self-esteem thing. True humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking about yourself less. It is thinking of yourself less. You see, the thing is, if you've ever met a truly humble person, a person who really has that character quality of humility, you'd never walk away from that person and say, oh my gosh, that person is so humble. You'd never do that. And you probably have never walked away from a conversation saying, oh my goodness, that person is so incredibly humble. Because somebody who is truly humble, you walk away from that conversation and you go, wow, that person is so incredibly content. They're happy with their lives. And they were so interested in me and what I had going on in my life. Because the truly humble person doesn't spend the whole conversation running all kinds of different calculations on their life and what you're thinking about them and trying to make sense of that. So, that's what pride is. That is what the poison of pride is. Pride is the ruthless, sleepless, unsmiling concentration on the self that can present itself as superior to others, that can present itself as inferior to others. So what? I mean, that's how the Bible defines pride. Like, how bad is it? Well, if we're thinking about this in terms of poisons, and that's kind of the idea that we've got throwing through this sermon, if that's the poison of pride, how toxic is pride really? I mean, it's pride, Jason. I'm not murdering anybody. I'm not committing adultery. I'm not stealing money. I'm not really breaking any of the Ten Commandments if I think about it. I'm just kind of a little bit prideful, and I think a little bit too much of myself, or I don't think enough of myself. How bad is pride? Well, look at the story. Look again at chapters 3, 5, and 6. Chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. When this happens, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they made known to him his people, Haman sought to destroy all of the Jews. How toxic is pride? Pride is so toxic that you can be affronted by one person and decide that you want to kill their entire ethnic group. That's how toxic pride is. I want you to see that pride is, like, really bad. Went so far, Haman does, as to make an irrevocable law. He goes to the king. He basically deceives him, makes this irrevocable law. Thousands of people are going to die because of Haman's pride. So, number two, the toxicity of pride. How bad is it? What does pride do that makes it so toxic? Here's a couple of things. Number one, pride makes you a fool. Pride makes you a fool. The book of Proverbs has a lot to say about pride. Proverbs 16, verse 5, the Lord detests all the proud of heart. Be sure of this, they will not go unpunished. Proverbs 16, verse 19, better to be lowly in spirit along with the oppressed than to share plunder with the proud. Proverbs 21, verse 4, haughty eyes and a proud heart, the unplowed field of the wicked produce sin. So haughty eyes and a proud heart, the unplowed field of the wicked, what does that field produce? It produces sin. The reason that pride makes you a fool is because, firstly, pride stops you from ever learning from your mistakes. A heart that is proud is always trying to convince itself that it is right. A heart that is full of pride, anytime anything doesn't work out, it's always somebody else's fault. It's really, really interesting because if you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, I think you can make the case that the first sin was pride, and the second sin born out of that pride was to blame. Adam says, Eve made me do it. Eve says, the snake made me do it. And they blamed and they blamed and they blamed and they blamed. Where did that come from? It came from pride. You see, the person who's prideful and can never learn from their mistakes, they never think that the fault lies with them. It's always somebody else's fault. It's always something else's fault. It's some bad luck. It's some fault in a set of circumstances. But it is never, ever, 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 ever you. It's never your fault. It's never your responsibility. And because you are always trying to convince yourself that it is somebody else's fault and somebody else's problem, you're never able to learn from your mistakes. You see, a humble person is not always looking at themselves, measuring themselves against other people, needing to find faults, but rather they're able to look at themselves. A humble person can learn from their mistakes. They can laugh at themselves. They can admit that they have made a mistake. The humble person, in contrast to the proud person, learns quickly. They learn very, very quickly because when they see something goes wrong, when something has gone wrong, even if they know it might not completely be their fault, they're still looking at the situation, asking themselves, what part did I have to play in this? But it's not just that pride makes you a fool and that you can't learn from your mistakes. Pride makes you a fool because you're not able to take criticism on board. Now, the book of Proverbs says that where there is wise counsel, where there is wise counsel, plans will succeed. But the person who struggles to take criticism on board, if they have the superior form of pride that they struggle with, well, when criticism comes, they're like, surely they're not talking about me. I know better. Or if you struggle with the inferior form of pride and you receive criticism, it just crushes you. And it absolutely breaks you. And that pride means that you can never take criticism, which means that you can never learn from your mistakes, which the Bible says makes you a fool. And that means that you enter into this cycle of making foolish choices over and over and over. Foolish relational choices, foolish work choices, foolish financial choices, and the list goes on and on and on. Pride, though, doesn't just make you a fool. Number two, pride actually makes you evil. Pride, since the days of St. Augustine, the church has understood that pride is the root behind all sin. Like I said, back in Genesis chapter 3, I think you can make the case that pride was perhaps the first sin. Satan wanted what he could not have, and he convinced God's creations, Adam and Eve, that he knew and that they therefore knew better than God who had created them. What is that other than pride? Pride is the place that allows all kinds of other gross stuff to grow and develop and gain traction in your life. Pride is kind of that, you know that place where the shower drains and every now and then you got to get in there and you got to clean it out and you discover that there's all kinds of really gross, disgusting stuff in there and bleach just won't cut it. You actually have to get in there and get it all out. That's pride. And all kinds of other stuff starts growing in there. That's what pride is. Pride is the place where that grows. You see, when you're angry at someone, pride is what allows you to keep on being angry at someone. When you envy someone, pride is there because you feel that you deserve what they have. When you deceive someone or lie, it is your pride that gets in the way. You know, you think about it, and how many of us are not guilty of this? Oh, I'm really sorry I was late. I got stuck in traffic. Now, let me be honest with you, there's just not that much traffic in Raleigh, so it's really difficult to get stuck in traffic, so I'm always surprised when I hear people got caught in traffic and that's why they're late. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But why do we lie in one situation and not in another situation? Why do I say, oh, I'm really sorry I was late, I got caught in traffic, when I actually didn't? I was just late and I wanted that extra cup of coffee and therefore I was late. Well, it's pride. I don't want that person to think worse of me. And so I lie. I lie in one situation and not another situation because I'm worried about my reputation. And what's at the heart of that? Well, what's at the heart of that is pride. What's at the heart of anxiety or worry? What it flows out of the need to be in control or to have expectations met. It's pride. It takes a whole lot of arrogance to put yourself into a position where you know better and you know what the outcome has to be or must be. At the heart of murder, I would say, is pride. At the heart of adultery is pride. At the heart of stealing is pride. At the heart of failing to honor your parents is pride. At the heart of sin is pride. Number three, why is pride so toxic? Well, it's because pride hides itself. Pride is the only sin that the more proud that you are, the less proud that you think you are. You know, you know when you're killing someone. You don't look up and go, oh my goodness, I'm killing you, I'm so sorry. You know when you're committing adultery. You don't know, oh my gosh, you're not my wife, how did you get into my bed? You know when you're stealing. I definitely don't earn that much money. How did that get in my bank account? But you don't know when you're committing the sin of pride. Have you ever had a conversation with someone who says to you, oh my goodness, you know, maybe you're in a community group, maybe you're in your small group, maybe you're in, you know, something, and you talk with a Christian, and they're saying, you know, I'm really struggling with, I'm sure you've heard many things, I'm really struggling with this, I'm really struggling with that. Have you ever had someone say to you, oh my goodness, I'm really struggling with pride this week? Has anybody ever confessed their pride to you? I've never had that. In 20-something years of ministry, I've never had somebody come to me and say, I'm really struggling with pride. In fact, there's a guy named Joseph Epstein who has a book on pride, and he says in his book, so many people hate snobs, but you can only hate snobs if you feel superior to them, which means that hating snobs is a form of snobbery. A truly humble person doesn't feel superior to anyone. Number four, honestly, I need you to be honest now. Let me just tell you how toxic pride is, how badly pride hides itself. Honestly, up until this point of time in this sermon, haven't you been thinking about one or two people that you really wish were here tonight listening to this sermon? Or that you really wish would listen to the sermon? That's how sinister, that's how toxic pride actually is. And number five, pride is so toxic because religion just makes pride worse. Religion just makes pride worse. When you bring religion to pride, it's like pouring gasoline over an open flame. In Luke chapter 18, Jesus tells the story to some who were confident of their own righteousness. That is, they were prideful in their own righteousness. They looked down on everyone else. Jesus told them this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other was a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all that I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled. All those who demonstrate pride will be humbled, and those who humble themselves, they will be exalted. You see, if you just pour religion over pride, if you just try and fix the sin of pride with more religion, it's going to do one of two things. It's going to either make you feel very superior because look at me, look how wonderful I am. Look at all these religious things that I do. Look at me, I'm just a good old Pharisee. Or you try and pour religion over pride and it makes you feel inferior. I am so bad. I am so bad, so bad, so bad, so bad, so bad. And you get completely down on yourself. How can we guard against the sin of self-righteousness? Well, I think first, it's by seeking out an attitude of humility that's based on the truth, but for the grace of God, go I. It's interesting how David can quote can say in Psalm 51, verse 5, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. I think another means of guarding against the self-righteousness of pride is by identifying ourselves with how God sees us. Yes, sinful, but forgiven through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Which is probably at this point you're saying, okay, Jason, can you get on to point number three? What's the antidote to pride? What can I do about it? I'm pretty sure you're going to say something about loving God or Jesus or something about doing this or doing that, and actually I'm not. I'm not going to say that tonight. Because the antidote to pride is not what you think it is. Let's go back to the story for just a second. Chapter 6. On the night the king could not sleep, he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles that were read before the king. So basically, he can't sleep. He needs an audiobook. They didn't have Amazon back then, so he calls in one of the scribes, and they read him the book. And basically, you got to understand, this book is like going over to the state senate and getting the minutes and asking for those to be read to you, all right? This was probably the most boring book you could probably read because he wanted to sleep, but he couldn't sleep. He couldn't sleep. And so what gets read to him? Well, a couple of chapters ago, at the end of chapter 2, we read the story of how Mordecai overheard a couple of the king's guards plotting to assassinate the king. And he got word to Esther, and she intervened and saved the king's life. And that was written down in this book that was now being read to the king. And the king says, well, what did we do to honor Mordecai? And the scribe looks and says, well, we didn't do anything. And kind of at that moment or that morning, Haman walks into the room. And the king says to Haman, Haman, what should we do for the man that the king delights to honor? What should we do? So Haman comes into the king. Verse 7, and Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, this is what should be done. Let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, the horse that the king has ridden on and whose head and put on his head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble officials, and let them dress the man whom the king delights in, and be taken to the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man in whom the king delights to honor. Okay, so just so you know, all right, full disclosure, Haman walks in and thinks that the king is talking about him, and he thinks that what he's saying to the king, Ahasuerus, that the king is going to do that to him. All right? It's ludicrous what he is asking for at this point. And yet, what Haman is asking for is not the wrong thing. He's asking the wrong person. He's not asking for the wrong thing. He's asking the wrong king for that thing. The king turns, and in one of the most wild and crazy bits of reversal in the whole story, and you got to come back next week because next week's all about reversals. In the craziest reversal of the whole story, the king turns to Haman and says, Mordecai is the man that I delight in. Now you go and do this. Haman had just come in from building a gallows to have Mordecai hung on. He walked in that morning to say to the king, hey, can I please have special permission to kill Mordecai? And the king says, now you go walk through the streets and you go and you honor Mordecai. The reason that I say it's not that Haman asked for the wrong thing, it's that he asked the wrong person. It's because that's not something that King Ahasuerus could give him. The thing that Haman wanted more than anything else was for the person that he thought the world of, the emperor, to think the world of him. One writer puts it that what we desire, we want the praise of the praiseworthy. But what you need to understand tonight is that no human being can ever give that to you. That is beyond what any human being can possibly do. Many years later, there was another king who was clothed in a purple robe. What's really interesting about that king is that there were lots that were cast for his robe, and he was stripped of that robe. What you got to understand about the robe that Haman was asking for, to be given the robe of the emperor was to be clothed in and to partake in the rule of the king, to be given the honor and the glory and the praise and the adulation of the king himself. Well, a few hundred years later, there was another king who walked a road, who was stripped of his robe, whose robe was taken, lots were cast for it. In fact, we read in John chapter 19 that when the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his garments, they divided them into four parts, one part for each soldier, and also his tunic. But when they got to the tunic was seamless. It was woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it shall be. Casting lots is back in chapter 3 of Esther. This was to fulfill the scripture which says, They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. You see, Jesus was stripped naked, not just physically, but also spiritually. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says that for our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24 says, he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds we have been healed. He was stripped naked and clothed with our sin, with our pride, in order that we might be clothed with his righteousness and reconciled to God. It was by his wounds that we have been healed. The wounds that our pride causes us, the gouges of which all kinds of things fester out of, he took that upon himself. This wasn't just a reversal, this was the great exchange, where he who knew no sin became sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. In 1 Peter, Peter will say that actually of this people, we are now chosen, a royal priesthood. We are a holy possession. Literally, and it talks about this all the time in the Old Testament, and Peter picks it up here, that we are God's treasured possession. You see, God is the one who delights in us. In John chapter 17, Jesus actually prays, Father, the glory that I know of you, the glory that has been revealed to me, give that glory to them. And what you need to understand about glory is delight. It is affirmation. That was what Haman wanted, what he so desperately wanted from the emperor. He wanted the glory, but it wasn't the emperor's glory to give. And so what we need to understand about the antidote to sin is that it doesn't begin by trying harder or by adding more religion or by doing, or even by trying to put to death pride. If you try and put to death pride, do you know what you're going to do? You're just going to pour gasoline on that flame. The more you try to put to death pride, you're more like, oh my goodness, I'm so proud of how I'm putting to death my pride. That's what it does. The only way to deal with pride is to know that God the Father has sent God the Son to go through all of that for you. And that not only has God sent his Son to go through all of that for you, but he chose to do that because he loves you more infinitely than you could ever imagine. And so that is where you go looking for your value and your significance. That he went to the cross and he did so willingly and lovingly and obediently to the Father. Which is why Paul can write in Philippians chapter 2, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. And then talking about Christ can say, who being in very nature God, didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped or used to his own advantage. But rather, he made himself nothing. He took on the very nature of a servant. He was made in human likeness, and he was found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. Jesus not only had to die for you, he chose to die for you. And when you understand that, and only when you understand that can you begin to have your motivations changed and transformed by the gospel. You see, friends, the first step in this journey to deal with our pride is to realize that you're proud in the first place. The first step in the journey to dealing with your pride is to realize that you are proud in the first place. Pride is a poison. It is so toxic that it will kill you. But God has provided an antidote, and the antidote is bound up that he chose you, that he loves you, that he sent his Son for you, that you might share in his glory. And as you learn to rest in that, you can learn, like Paul says, to do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but rather in humility to value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. I'm going to encourage you to just bow your heads where you are and to take a few moments to pray. And to pray that the Lord would enable you this evening to take that first step. That the Lord would shine on you and in your life those places where you're proud, where you don't even know it. That you might bring them to Him, that He might heal your wounds. I'm just going to leave you in a few moments of quiet. And after that, we're going to sing together.